Welcome back to another week of Torah Study. I hope you're all excited for a week free of pizza and sandwiches. I must admit, I've always been a huge fan of matzah brei. A little salt and a little jam. But the way this year's Torah portion schedule falls means that we actually don't get our Passover reading until next week. And wow, do we have a special guest for you. This week, we are in Parsha Tzav, the 24th Parsha, and it continues the long list of sacrifices and all their prescribed rules and regulations. Last week, we wanted to think about sacrifices by way of our relationship to animals, where this week, we went with something different. As you'll hear me say in just a minute or two, these are the parshiot that can be hard to connect with, because, I don't know about you, but I haven't been sacrificing animals, nor do I have any plans to. So what is there to make from an entire week that tells me how long the high priests are supposed to let a sacrificial offering burn? Enter Daniel Pikus, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies and the Ancient World in the Department of Global Humanities and Religions at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. Daniel is a specialist in late antiquity Judaism and Christianity and studies how ancient Jews and Christians read earlier texts like the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, and the New Testament. In fact, he's currently working on a book on rabbinic reading practices, and his expertise will help shine a light on the different ways we can read these passages on sacrifice, but also the historic relevance of reading them at all. Daniel is chair of the Book, History, and Biblical Literatures Program Group in the Society of Biblical Literature and deputy Judaism editor at the Ancient Jew Review. With Professor Fanny Bialik's help, we'll try to understand the historical context of sacrifices. What was society like when sacrifice was integral to its way of life? And how did a people transition from a tight-knit society that burned animals as offerings to God to communities spread across the globe practicing their religion by way of the book? Just like we're doing here. It's an exciting conversation that really helped put some things in context, even though Daniel says context might be of least importance. I do hope you join us next week. I'm sure we'll all be done with matzah by then, because our Pesach episode is gonna be fun. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts, and join the family over at patreon.com/thestudy. To help keep these episodes cranking. We're prepping some really exciting stuff over here, and yeah, I can't wait for you to hear. Okay, on to the show. Welcome back to another episode of The Study. We've got Parsha Tzav this week, welcoming back as co-host, Professor Fanny Bialik. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
And today in Le Hot Seat, we have got Daniel Pikus, who is an assistant professor of biblical studies and the ancient world in the Department of Global Humanities and Religion at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. Thanks so much for being here, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Really, really excited about this week. And I think you're going to help us shine some light on context and understanding some history and our place in it. I feel like maybe the way to start this week is just to jump right in to Parsha Tzav, which translates to command. That's the English translation. And we actually get a continuation from last week in that we have more, drumroll, sacrifices. We hear how the offering should be burned and how long the fire shall be lit, what should be done with all of the leftovers, which sacrifices can be eaten after they are burned and which have to be burned completely. We get instructions for sin offerings, for gratitude offerings, which are my favorite, guilt offerings, and then we have a kind of grand opening of the Mishkan You know, we've spent so long actually building this thing. It's time to sacrifice some animals for all the mentioned reasons. So Moses gathers the community, calls Aaron and his sons to the front of the line, who put on all of the cool clothing that has been instructed over the past few parshas. They anoint the tabernacle with the oils and the incense we discussed a few weeks ago, and start a big inaugural sacrificial barbecue. So last week we talked about sacrifice specifically in the context of our dominion over animals when it comes to eating them, but it's kind of hard to wrap my head around what to make all of this as a modern Jew. You know, is this just a part of history? Is it okay that it feels so alien? You know, how can we connect to these parshiot? And we thought it might be helpful this week to take a look at this era of Jewish history, because a lot of these instructions can feel so alienating simply because we no longer do these things. So Daniel, can you help us understand what the world was like when people practiced these rituals?
I can do my absolute best.
Wonderful. I'll take it.
Yeah. Not having a time machine, though, you know, could be very wrong. There's two things about sacrifice that I run into time and again with my students and also with my own sort of thinking about sacrifice before I got really kind of stuck into thinking about it in its ancient context. And these two things kind of helped me to reorient myself in how to think about sacrifice in the Tanakh. I think the first one is that today we're really used to thinking about sacrifice as deprivation. So to sacrifice something means that you no longer have it. It means that you have given something up.
And that it was something you had before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That you're losing something. And then the other thing that we need to sort of get outside of is this idea of the sort of meaningful part of sacrifice, especially with animal sacrifice, being the animal's death, right? Being that it's about killing, that it's about, you know, giving up a life in some way. I mean, there's sort of a million things to say about that, you know, not the least of them being where we really get those ideas from, which is really early Christianity and the influence it has had on the modern world. But starting with the idea of deprivation, I found it really helpful to think about, instead of thinking about sacrifice as sort of giving something up or losing something, it's better to think about it as a gift. So when you give someone a gift, sure, it's a thing that you no longer have, but the absence of it is not what's important, right? What's important is that someone else now has it. And with a sacrifice, you're giving God a present.
That's actually my favorite form of gift giving, is the re-gift. You know, when you have something and you just continue, it continues on its journey.
Yeah, exactly. God provided the grain and the oil, and then he gets it right back.
And then we re-gift it. I love that.
Yeah. Well, so interestingly, though, it appears once in this portion, it appears a lot in the next one, Shemini, the part of the sacrifice that God really loves, right, is the Reach Nichoach. The pleasing odor, which surely I have no doubt that God could provide a pleasing odor for God's self in the context of the text, but it's sort of the act of what's happening with the sacrifice, right, is the production of the odor that, you know, if you think of the sort of smoke and incense, it goes up towards where God is. And, you know, there's lots of scholarship kind of thinking about all of these different types of sacrifices and the names they have. They're all, in some way, related to this idea of reciprocity, of gift-giving, of giving something and also getting something back. I think that's also a very clear part of what sacrifice is in the Hebrew Bible.
Hmm. So that seems like it also differs in some ways from our contemporary our very Christianized understandings of sacrifice, where it's something I give up not expecting reciprocity, since Christianity moves us away from the rule of reciprocity.
Absolutely, right? This is the you know, without getting too technical, right? This is the Greek word charis, or the English word grace, which is critical in Christianity and is not present in the Hebrew Bible. Grace meaning given without expecting return. But even from the names of these sacrifices, right? The purification offering, the thanksgiving offering, they're given both to affect something or as a response to something, but really maybe the better way to think about it as part of a much longer chain of things that are happening, right? God is sort of continually giving, we are continually giving back, and this is kind of the process that and by which people are sort of continually sacrificing. And that's, you know, if you look at Homer, for example, that's absolutely how Greek sacrifice was also envisioned, ancient Rome as well.
Just trying to understand how that differs, or I guess how the Jewish idea of the reciprocity works differently. So I understand that grace, we are not expecting anything back, but if what Jews are expecting back is life and breath in our lungs, how is that different than any other religious belief of what we receive from God?
Yeah, I think it's actually much more material and mundane in the Tanakh. What is expected back from God is causing the plants to grow, is property and prosperity and health. Deuteronomy is really clear about this. It shows up in, you know, Numbers as well, that we're not doing it just because God said so, right? Mm-hmm. That we're doing it because God said, you do this, and I'm giving you something in return. I mean, that's what God says to Abraham in Genesis, right? Circumcise yourself, and I make you a great nation, right? I make you prosperous.
So it has this flavor then of being a gift, but that's also transactional, which I think is, you know, familiar to us from certain kinds of gift giving that we might mm-hmm. think of as disordered, maybe. But like that you know, you don't want to give a gift to someone who isn't going to give you one back or whatever it is. That like we sort of have gifts are extra; they're not paying our rent. But they have the expectation of reciprocation, and so gifts to God are structured in that way. And just for the brief like anachronism back to modernism, Daniel and I went to grad school together, and he knows about the ancient world, and I know nothing about it. But the modern world, in the modern world, back to the last 400 years, I think a lot of the interpretation of what the movement is into grace comes from thinking about the Sermon on the Mount and the idea of rejecting reciprocity. So our listeners might know that sermon best for things like if someone hits you on one cheek, to turn the other cheek also. That is a foundation of nonviolence, but it's also a foundation of the idea that we don't give, like Christians don't give back what is given to them. And that creates a more fundamental sense of gift giving in Christianity is supposed to be non-reciprocal, is supposed to not expect that kind of reciprocity. And that's modeled on the love of God. Whereas in Judaism, the gift giving can expect reciprocity. It's more communal. And it also has that reciprocity with God, if I'm understanding you correctly, Daniel.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking even more basically, like I have birthday present friends and I have friends who are not birthday present friends, right? I have friends who give me birthday presents who I give birthday presents back to because that's the way our relationship works. And I have friends who are just as dear to me, but who I don't, because maybe our relationship of reciprocity works differently, or maybe our relationship is less reciprocal. But the relationship between God and Israel and the Tanakh is absolutely construed as being reciprocal.
Mm-hmm. That actually helps put in context Jewish guilt, because I feel like the whole I give you a gift and you give me nothing in return. We can just tie it right here. Absolutely. To Parshat Tzav. Great.
I'm suddenly feeling like I really need to start sending you birthday presents, Daniel. Party friends, but
exactly, birthday party friends and also card friends, although you're much better at sending me cards than I'm at sending them back.
Cards don't have to be reciprocal. That's part of the idea. I want to poke a little bit at the sense of the mundane and the reciprocity. So I think part of our interest in our excitement about talking to you this week is that we're in this part of Torah where we get all of these really material instructions and descriptions of everything that's going on. This is a parsha that's a little bit more descriptive than instructive, but though related. And I at least find these, especially in the sacrifice part, just really hard to follow. Like, it seems like such a strange procedure. And when I try to imagine myself in it, I get stuck on the fact that I'm not in it. The most of the ancient Israelites are not participating in this activity. It's a thing that is happening by the priests in the Mishkan. And I'm wondering what your sense is for an ancient Israelite. Sorry to keep asking you to do this anachronism of making you yourself one, but like, would that have seemed strange to them that something is happening secretly in the Mishkan, or is that sort of how a lot of their neighbors would have been practicing religions, or how can we think about that distance from the ritual for the rest of us? I mean, I'm not a Kohen, I'm not a Levite, like, right. I'm not going to be part of, I'm a woman too, so I'm not definitely not going to be part of any of this. So how do we think about that kind of distance, and how does that sit in context in the ancient world?
Yeah, it's a great question. So thinking with comparative evidence, so we think about Greek temples and Roman temples. Greek temples probably roughly contemporaneous with the temple in Jerusalem. The action is not happening inside the temple. The action is happening outside the temple. So it's happening in public, and it's also happening, especially if you're making burnt offerings, it's happening where the smoke doesn't make the interior of a building that you spent a lot of money to get beautiful. The smoke doesn't make it all stained and gross.
Fair.
There are some things that happen inside the temple. So Greek temples had what we call cult statues standing in the middle, a statue of the deity that would often literally be dressed or clothed, would sometimes be anointed with oil. There'd be incense perhaps offered around it to cleanse the air and to make it a pleasant place to be, but only highly initiated priests would be present in there. And that's really analogous to the Holy of Holies, to the Kodesh Kodeshim in the Mishkan, or perhaps, or more archaeologically, tenably, the temple in Jerusalem. Only the priests, or even the Kohen Gadol, would go right into this middle of the temple, which is where the ark is. Although the ark would be sometimes brought out and paraded, there are various biblical stories that do suggest that, right? The big public sacrifices, the ones that kind of mark festivals, the ones that you would make pilgrimage for, so the regalim sacrifices, those are happening out of doors and kind of where everyone can see. And they're also probably happening over a broad area of land, because you got a lot of families who want to make their Passover sacrifice, and you got a lot of priests who have to probably have a super organized system to make it happen quickly, because the holiday is only 8 days long, 7 days, excuse me, in the Bible. To that degree, then, the question of distance is a little bit lessened, because, of course, you wouldn't be totally distant from it. You'd see part of it. There are regular sacrifices, daily sacrifices, for example, the Tamid. Those are probably more private. Those are probably happening, if not, certainly not in the Holy of Holies, but in a more private enclosure mm-hmm. of the sanctuary. Mm-hmm.
So we should be imagining less for sort of sacrifices in general for ancient Israelites, imagining less the Kohen Gadol sacrifices that happen so far away from the average Jew, and much more the like fish fry kind of like big barbecue version of it that we're all having some access to, and there's like a communal religious experience happening as well. It's not just about the sacrifice in relation to God. There's also all of this community.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I imagine I would need to reread the text to be totally clear on this. But at sort of big festivals, surely, you know, the Kohen Gadol obviously has a central role, right? But he's not the only one officiating various sacrifices. And as you see, you see in Sav really nicely, some of the sacrifices are the sort of more big communal, what you call the fish fry sacrifice, barbecue. Some of them are much more, when you're lighting some grain on fire, you're obviously, no one's eating that afterwards, right? But it produces a nice sort of warm, toasty smell that God really likes, and also probably smells relatively good in a large open space where there's a lot of animal slaughter happening.
And this parsha does end with Moses calling the entire community forward. So I feel like the final Absolutely. Idea of this is to bring everyone together to witness Absolutely. And be a part of these offerings.
Yeah, well, and at the end of Tzav, certainly, it's sort of the investiture of Aaron, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of he's, you know, so dedicating the Mishkan and sort of initiating the role of Kohen Gadol in a really serious way.
Hmm. Is it possible, just because I know for myself, and we have listeners from all walks of life, do you mind walking us through Kohen Gadol and what that idea actually means?
Yeah, of course. So the Kohen means priest in biblical Hebrew. It specifically means a priest of the Israelites. There are other words for foreign priests. And the Kohen Gadol means the great priest or the high priest. So he's the priest who both is in charge of sort of the administration of the sacrifices and of everything that's going on around the Mishkan or the temple. And then he's also the Aaron, at least, is the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, as the sort of initiator of the line of high priests. There are parts of the Bible where different families claim the high priesthood. You know, there's sort of the Zadokite priests and the Aaronite priests, and they have a lot of fights. There was another group of priests, the Korachites, who the whole story of Korach getting swallowed up by the earth is probably happening because the Aaronite priests came into power, didn't want the Korachite priests getting any
Wow, high drama.
Extremely. The battling over the priesthood is like the highest drama you could get.
Amazing.
And of course, the priests were members of the tribe of Levi, which, according to the Tanakh, is the tribe that was not given an area of land in the land of Canaan. And therefore, they are supported by the offerings, both monetary and also, you know, in terms of movable goods, of the other tribes. So that probably helps explain a little bit in Tzav, where we have certain sacrifices where you give certain parts of the animal to the priest, like the, a certain thigh or a certain breast. It's because the priests do not own farms with which to provide their own sacrifice. And this ties back, by the way, to that second thing that we, you know, about reframing sacrifice, where we think about the death of the animal as the important thing. It's actually, the death of the animal is incidental, because when it's an animal with sacrifice, what happens afterwards is part of it gets eaten. Mm. And you can't eat a live animal.
Says you.
Well, also says kashrut.
Okay, fine.
The priesthood operating and getting its livelihood, really, from these offerings and being able to support itself. Also, in a society that's like largely agrarian, where meat is consumed maybe once a week, priests had it real good.
Is there any connection between, we're at Shabbat HaGadol, and is there a connection between Kohen HaGadol kind of taking charge here and Shabbat HaGadol? Are they two totally different things?
Different, other than the word HaGadol, meaning the great. Okay, great. Shabbat HaGadol is traditionally the Shabbat before Pesach, which begins Saturday evening. The, you know, and Kohen Gadol, high priest, or the great priest, the great Kohen. Yeah, it's sort of an accident of language, although Tzav, of course, does end up being the parsha for Shabbat HaGadol with, you know, somewhat regularly, just because of the way the Torah portions work. The naming of Shabbat HaGadol is pretty obscure. You read a special haftarah to mark the day from Malachi that uses the phrase the great day of Adonai, which is where some people think the term, you know, the great Shabbat came from. It's a later tradition, maybe medieval, a little bit later even. Some people also think it was named the Great Shabbat because the tradition was to give an extremely long Dvar Torah. Don't know how many people would think that makes it a great Shabbat, but there you go.
The rabbi.
Mostly the rabbi.
Exactly.
it's the one out of the year when you can charge more in your speaking fee for coming. I used to think that Shabbat HaGadol was great because the story was going to be really good, and then I realized that, like, actually we're in a part of Torah where often the story is, it's not particularly dramatic. Yeah. And certainly not compared to the next week when we read about Exodus, so I was always confused and slightly disappointed, but oh well. The Malachi,
yeah, Well, and you know, the rabbis who sort of formed the liturgical calendar, I think also knew that, because the readings for Passover are high drama and wonderful, super right, fun. Right. So,
right.
Because you mentioned the Haftarah, I'm wondering if we can do two things. One, do you mind defining Haftarah for anyone who thinks that is half a Torah? and then, because you brought it up, can we talk about this Haftarah? We've never really discussed Haftarahs on this podcast. We just kind of do the text of the Parsha itself. So kind of exciting to have this opportunity to unpack it.
Yeah, absolutely. You stole my joke. I was going to say Haftarah is not half a Torah.
It's the one we have. It's the only one.
It's actually from a totally different word than Torah. It's spelled with a tet instead of a taf, so it's a different T sound in Hebrew, but means something like completion. And Haftarah is a section from the prophets, so from the Ketuvim part of the Tanakh. From the Nevi'im, I don't know why I said Ketuvim, from the Nevi'im, from the prophetic part of the Tanakh, that you read after the regular Torah portion. So there's some really famous ones. For example, when you read the crossing of the Red Sea and the Song of the Sea, Shirat Hayam, the Haftarah for that is the story of Deborah from the Book of Judges, which concludes with the Song of Deborah, which the Song of the Sea and the Song of Deborah have these really sort of beautiful literary parallels. And one of the ways that special weeks of the year are marked in Judaism is by doing a Haftarah that is not the Haftarah that's normally associated with that Torah portion. So like we have this week, I think the normal Haftarah for Tzav is Jeremiah, which, as Jeremiah tends to be, is very gloomy.
There's a reason it's called a Jeremiah.
Exactly. But the Haftarah for Shabbat HaGadol is from Malachi. I wouldn't say it's cheerful, Malachi chapter 3, but it's not Jeremiah. It's sort of, you have the great day of the Lord. It's very grand. It's sort of very, I don't want to say universal, but it has an enormous scope, which is appropriate for a Shabbat that is known as the Great Shabbat.
And for our listeners who haven't seen this service, or maybe have seen it without knowing quite what's going on, what does this look like in synagogue? Can you walk us through the practice in modern synagogue? And then maybe we can talk about where it comes from.
So on a regular Shabbat, depending on the type of synagogue you're in, there will be, very traditionally, there are seven Torah portions, or seven sort of short readings from the Torah portion. Some synagogues only do three. It sort of totally depends on where you are. And then, very traditionally, after the seven readings, there's a maftir, which is often just normally just a repetition of the seventh Torah reading. Sometimes, actually, on other special Shabbats, it's from a totally different part of the Torah. So that's why sometimes you'll bring out two Torahs or even three Torahs when parading them around the synagogue. And then after the maftir, the Torah is lifted up and shown to the community. And then someone in the synagogue I grew up in, for example, the person who said the blessing for the maftir reads the Haftarah. So it's really interesting, because some synagogues actually have Haftarah scrolls, which are like the Torah scrolls, except they have individual prophetic books written on them, and the Haftarah will be read from them. That's incredibly rare, though. More normally, the Haftarah will be read from sort of modern copy of the Bible, a Chumash, you know, a book that has all of the Haftarahs and all the Torah portions arranged by chronologically, by when you would read them. And the other very significant thing about the Haftarah is, at least in the, say, in the Eastern European sort of prayer tradition that I grew up in, the Torah portion is chanted in a major key, and the Haftarah is chanted in a minor key. So even sonically, you can immediately differentiate what is happening. That, you know, that doesn't always work. There are other communities where the Torah portion is also done in a minor key, et cetera, et cetera. But at least in the synagogue I grew up in, it was always this really clear marker.
That's how you can tell how late you are.
Exactly.
That's really funny. Well, unless it's a tone deaf shul, and then you have no idea where you are.
So. Absolutely.
We'll be right back. The combination of gratitude and ritual practices can be deeply powerful and sacred. One Table invites you to bring these practices to your next Shabbat dinner. They're here to help you hold that magic of Shabbat while protecting each other. Even when you're alone, Shabbat is a built-in reminder to do something a little special for yourself. Plus, One Table helps out with small financial gifts so you can make sure it's extra special. Head to onetable.org to start.
So one of the reasons I'm so excited to have you on to talk about this parsha and also these sort of parts of how we read Torah is because so much of this is shaped in the period that you're an expert in, which is not the period we've just been talking about in the sacrifices. And thank you for indulging our ancient Israelite questions. But in the rabbinic period, in the period when Judaism changes from being a religion that is focused on the practices that are happening at the temple, and this is after the destruction of the temple, and becomes something that, at least in my mind, is closer to what we have today, and shapes a lot of the text that we have today. And so, can you give us, again, asking for intros, but can you give us an intro to what rabbinics is, and then maybe talk us through some of the relationship to sacrifice. What happens with sacrifice after the temple's destroyed?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite things to talk about. So from the first to the early third centuries of the Common Era, so from, around the years, like, say, 1 to 200, there's sort of a loose group starts forming in the land of Israel, in the Roman province of Judea, that we eventually coalesce into what we call the rabbis, which is, of course, a term that is probably familiar to many of us. The early rabbis were textual experts. They were sort of community judges, perhaps. They were local elites. They were, to some degree, maybe mediators between their communities and either other Jewish communities or their communities and the Roman state apparatus, depending on who the rabbi was. But one of the things that they are very concerned about early on is in the year 70, the temple is destroyed by the Roman general Titus, who then later became an emperor. The triumph of the spoils of the temple through Jerusalem, depicted on the Arch of Titus in Rome, very famous image. And of course, sacrifice ends after the temple. Well, I don't want to say ends, but there is no big sacrifice in the temple, let's say, after the temple is destroyed. And so the rabbis, depending on how you look at it, and I am totally being pithy here when I say the rabbis said, ooh, this is our chance. Because the rabbis were not really, some of them were from the priestly class, but most of them were probably not priests. And the priests are sort of, when the temple's destroyed, you don't need priests to do sacrifices anymore because you can't do sacrifice. So the rabbis start, well, so they do a bunch of things. One of the things they do is saying, okay, well, we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about the minutiae of sacrificial ritual to show that we are the real experts, which they do. The Mishnah, which is one of their earliest compositions, is filled with, and when the Kohen Gadol was making a sin offering, he did it exactly like this.
So elaborations of what we're seeing in this parsha.
Exactly. Yeah. But then one of the other things they do is say, but of course, we can't sacrifice anymore. So here are some things that you should do instead. And one of the biggest ones is the sort of weekly reading of the Torah. This was probably happening in some form before the temple was destroyed, because we have synagogues, for example, in Egypt and even in the land of Israel that are in existence before the temple is destroyed. And it seems that there was sort of an idea of the Tanakh was something that should be read in the synagogues, although the exact details are argued about at best. But eventually, and especially by the time of the Babylonian Talmud, which is a few hundred years after the destruction of the temple, the rabbis come up with a relatively robust sort of what we could call a reading calendar of here is the way the cycle of the year works. Here's how the five books of Moses fit into it. Here are how the prophets fit into it with the Haftarahs. And here are the special readings that you should do on certain holidays, which have only been added to in the centuries since. But the clearest distillation of this is a passage in the Babylonian Talmud in Tractate Ta'anit, page 27b, in case anyone wants to look it up. It was a centerpiece of my dissertation. That's the only way I have it memorized. Where Moses, or I think it's Moses, unless it's Abraham, pretty sure it's Moses, is receiving all of the sacrificial instructions from God and says, you know, God, this is really great. And then he looks at the specifically the chatat offering and the asham offerings. So what are typically translated as the sin offerings or the guilt offerings, the offerings you make to kind of wipe clean any accidentally or purposefully kind of accrued moral impurity. Moses says, what happens to us if the temple gets destroyed and we can't make sacrifices? Like, what if we accidentally accrue some sort of guilt and need to make a chatat and we can't make a chatat offering anymore? God says, don't worry about it. I have established the order of sacrifices, the seder of sacrifices, this long, you know, a written version of how the sacrifices should go. So as long as you read them, you'll be okay. It has the same effect, which is a really kind of, it's a remarkable, well, it's a very bit of, it's a bit of very fancy footwork on the rabbi's part, right? <I'm> saying, who needs sacrifice when you can do what we're telling you about? But it's also this sort of really profound statement about how important the act of reading the Tanakh was, right? And sort of what it was understood to be able to do and why it was for so long stayed so central.
So it was the reading of the recent history that became the practice and became what the community did together, mm-hmm. as a way of perpetuating and understanding both our past and like the stories of our ancestors.
It's almost like the rabbis are saying, well, the next best thing to having a big communal sacrifice barbecue is reading about having a big communal sacrifice barbecue, except that it's actually better because more of us can do it. Mm. And then the rabbis go on to say, except you have to do it these very particular ways, and really you should always ask us because we're the experts and you want to be doing it with us.
Right. So you create
a specific version.
You create a new priesthood out of that. But it sounds a little bit like when you get grounded or you just can't go out because it's rainy or something and you're a kid and your parents are like, the next best thing to a pool party is reading about a pool party. But
yeah, I should have been reading about barbecues this whole year that I've been missing my friends.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is real pandemic wisdom. The next best thing. Just read about everything. But part of what you're describing, though, is this enormous transfer of power. So a transfer of power from the Levites and the Kohanim who are in charge of the rituals that happen in the temple to the rabbis who are in charge of the reading practices that read about the temple. How do you think about that shaping the course of Jewish history, to just put it as sort of bluntly and insanely as I possibly could? But, you know, we think of ourselves as the people of the book, like that dates from the rabbinic period and not from Torah, and in some sense. And it really changes the character of the religion.
Yes and no. The no being just because sometimes it changes it in really surprising ways. So for me, one of the really kind of aha moments for thinking about this, one of the big, like, I don't want to say revelations, because that's not quite the right word, but one of the ways that this helped me kind of shape my thinking was to realize just how significant how naturalized almost the idea of reading became in Judaism, the sort of centrality of this book, the importance of this book, and the cycle of reading it, how natural it became, and the ways that that sort of, the way we sort of accept it as natural, kind of, I don't want to say, masks or covers up the ways in which it's like actually kind of crazy and weird and also incredible, right? So just to go back to an example I already gave for thinking about Haftarahs and Torah portions. So when we read Parsha Beshalach, the crossing of the Red Sea and the Song of the Sea, the Haftarah is the story of Deborah and the Song of Deborah. And the connection between, like, the connection between those two, it's, you know, partially formal. They're both kind of poems written in a really similar way. But that's also, like, deeply literary and, like, really kind of expansive and profound in ways that we often, if we're not careful, we often don't expect to think of, in, you know, both in terms of like a traditional liturgy, for example. We think of liturgy as being something that's often really rote and really formulaic, perhaps. But the juxtaposition of these two, as sort of standard as it might be, the fact that it happens every year, it's sort of this, the rabbis found it, the ancient rabbis found it, this really kind of endlessly generative juxtaposition for possibilities of thinking about, okay, well, what does this tell us about salvation? What does this tell us about redemption? What does this tell us about miracles? You know, what do these stories have to, what does this tell us about leaders, you know, or with Moses and Deborah? You know, I realize this is me getting very academic, but it helps us think about these really ancient Jews and ancient rabbis, the rabbis who are specifically writing the Mishnah and the Talmud and kind of setting up a lot of the liturgy that is still in some form practiced today. They're just as kind of creative, curious, intelligent, and also kind of like wildly experimental as we have the ability to be today. And I find that like a really remarkable thing to think with, and also a very difficult thing to keep in mind as someone who, you know, is a scholar of the ancient world. It's one of the hardest things that I try to teach my students is that people in the ancient world are people the same way we are, and their minds are capable of the same sorts of really bizarre and also wonderful thought experiments and creativities that ours are.
Mm-hmm. But we might not get their jokes.
Definitely don't get their jokes. I think the Talmud, there are days when I think the Talmud is like 90% jokes that we don't get. And like a lot of them are very dirty.
We can hope. I'm interested to hear you talk about the sort of placement of the text in the center and how weird that is in the week as we're preparing for Seder. Mm. So, I mean, Seder orients around a text, but it's also one of the primary times in the Jewish calendar that we orient around objects other than text. I guess we orient weekly around the candle lighting and the scents we smell for at the end of Shabbat and things like that. But I think of Seder as one of the major times in the year that, like, I have to get all these objects in order to symbolize stuff and have them on the table, and like it becomes less that we're people of the book and more that like now we have to have all the stuff and we have to
people of the plate
and we have to have the parsley and we eat the parsley. We don't just, and so it seems like in Seder we almost get a taste, so to speak, of the kind of materiality beyond the text that we're seeing described in this parsha. When in the rest of the year, we have such a primary relationship to text. And so maybe one thing that we learn from that, I'm wondering, is that we could imagine a version of our Jewish lives that are so much more structured in the way of the Seder, where we are like tasting mm-hmm. things. And every time we read about the sacrifice, we have brisket or whatever. But like, as we're thinking, that's good with you.
Right. I'm giving a big thumbs up.
As we're thinking about that, where does that textual primacy, what is it displacing? And what do you think it changes about the meaning of these parshiot that are much more material and much more sort of textural instead of textual in that sense?
Yeah, what a good question. So one of the things that for a long time I thought about it displacing and then realized I actually don't think it is that we think, you know, as people of the book with reading as primary, we often think of reading as a solitary activity. So okay, right, the sort of focus on texts makes us alone. Except that's one of the wonderful things about the synagogue service in Judaism, is that the reading is communal. And in fact, sometimes the reading is so communal, you have, you know, if you have all seven aliyot, you have a different person reading each one, and then another person reading the Haftarah. So that's sort of one thing to flag,
yeah,
let's say.
A reorientation, yeah.
Yeah. I will say, though, that the sort of idea of reading as extremely solitary and singular, this is particularly indicative of like a lot of sort of language that was popping up around the Protestant Reformation, right? The sort of idea, sola scriptura, scripture alone, that there's you and that there's you in the Bible, and in the sort of mediation between of liturgy and prayer and interpretation, that's sort of all bracketed.
So your current book project is on these rabbinic reading practices that you've just been talking about, and
it is.
I'm so excited for this book. I'm wondering sort of what, besides the communal nature of it, what are the things that make reading practices for the rabbis, the sort of early turn to the text after the move from sacrifice, what makes that different from reading today, or what we might think of as reading?
Perhaps this is not a new thing that I'm saying, but one of the ways that the rabbis reads that is so different from any assumption we have about text, although it still shows up a couple times in a few places these days, is that a text is not continuous, right? It's not a narrative read from beginning to end, or at least it's not only continuous. So there's the idea of the Torah reading cycle. So the five books of Moses are read continuously all year, every year. But the text itself is actually kind of composed of an ocean where every drop of water is a different verse. And they're all bumping up against each other and creating meaning in those interactions. And that's, many scholars have, I think James Kugel most famously has described the practice of midrash as kind of an orientation towards the text that understands it that way, right? So Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Genesis 3, those are not the only, or Genesis 1, 1, 1, 2, and 1, 3. Reading them in order is not the only way to understand them. There's a very famous rabbinic interpretation that takes, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and juxtaposes it with a line from Proverbs to think about God having a blueprint for creation. And, you know, one of the ways that we like to, today at least, that we like to respond to readings, really, of biblical texts that are different from our own is to say, well, they're taking it out of context, right? But the great thing about the rabbis, or the fascinating thing about the rabbis, is that that's kind of all they did. They loved it being out of context. This idea of context and continuation is like really a very contemporary concern.
And has a sort of structuring to it that tries to prioritize some sense of objectivity, some false sense of objectivity, more than a possibility of meaning and resonance in a different way. Yeah, really interesting.
That really makes me think about what we're doing here today and on the show, which I feel like so much of what I try to wrap my head around is context when it comes to Torah and understand where things come from and also the communal nature of Torah study, and that we have this text, and that is the modern day Jew and what we kind of rally around, because you study this and we are trying to do it, like how you see, like what, you know, we have this opportunity here with this podcast to be studying Torah. And is there a specific route we should be taking or can be taking that perhaps we haven't thought of yet when, yeah, I guess so much of what I'm trying to do is build context for something and realizing that like we started, it was just kind of the kernel, you take a kernel of an idea and expound on it. And but yeah, I'm so curious to hear like what you think the modern day work of this all is or can be.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of a lot of the early rabbinic commentaries on biblical books. So Breshit Rabbah, right? This sort of classical commentary on Genesis. It moves verse by verse, right? It actually, the very first part is that famous juxtaposition of Genesis 1:1 with Proverbs 8, but then it goes on to Genesis 1:2. But it has, I mean, how it's printed today, it has lengthy paragraphs for each verse or a couple paragraphs for each verse or even for each sets of words. And the rabbis do radically different things within every kind of interpretation for every verse. So sometimes they're saying, well, let's give some context. Like Abraham is sending Eliezer back to his homeland to find a wife for his son. So like, what, you know, let's provide a little bit more context for that. And they'll kind of make up a story about why that's happening, right? Which is, you know, in many ways, it's related to what we as historians try and do. It just has a different understanding of what evidence is. But then at other times, the rabbis will say, well, this is a funny word in the Torah. Like, why don't we either figure out what it means by reference to other languages, or why don't we come up with another list of funny words that just sort of riffs off this one? Or why don't we, you know, mention a couple of those funny words and then talk about some laws that have to do with sacrifice? The point being, right, that it's all kind of there. And the Talmud, of course, is the best example of this, is that it's just messy and wonderful and you know, there's context and there's law, but there's also stories and creativity and like every once in a while, a magical spell or a medical remedy or, you know, the two often the same thing. and it's wonderful. So, you know, that's me giving the podcast this is kind of like the Talmud stamp of approval.
We will take it.
That's awesome. I always wanted to learn to take notes like the Talmud authors, like that's sort of my ideal marginalia. So maybe it's the podcast format was what I was missing for
there you
achieving
go.
That goal.
Well, glad we could fill that void.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so, so much for taking the time today. I feel like we could talk about this forever. This was really, really helpful and a beautiful way to spend an hour. I really appreciate it. Fanny Bialik, thank you so much for taking the time to study some Torah today. Always appreciate your guidance and questions.
So great to be here. So great to have Daniel.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us and for all of your wisdom.
I had a blast. Thank you all so much.
To all of our listeners out there, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Isn't it strange, oh princesses and kings, in clown that it capers in, saw the swing.
The study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Fanny Bialik. Our guest was Daniel Pikus. Artwork by Julia Pott. Chag Pesach Sameach. See you next week.